When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
Now, here's a highlight from Coast to Coast AM on iHeartRadio.
And welcome back, George Norrie, along with Robert Young Pelton. Robert, we were talking about the Shah of Iran. He was not a Boy Scout by any means. We seem to back these people like Batista, who people just think are criminals.
Well, you got to remember the mindset back then, and even in Afghanistan, is that we are restoring some kind of royalty, which is going backwards, you know, and people say, well, why don't you elect those people in America? Why do we have to have these people back in power? So I think we pick what we think is the easiest way to put a ruler in power, but it's not what the people want. And those people usually end up getting kicked out.
Prior to the Shah, there was a guy in there named Mossadegh that we ousted. What was he like?
Well, you know, it's before my time, but Mossadegh was a very, you know, nationalist person, socialist, wanted to preserve Iran's assets and didn't like the idea of them being beholden to British and American oil companies, who he felt were just ripping them off. And so when he went to privatize the oil industry, he was overthrown.
Was he right?
Of course he's right, because the national asset is oil, right? And everybody's done that since, where Saudi Arabia, UAE, or whatever, they realize that that's their oil. It should be 90-20 or 90-10, not 10-90 type of thing.
And now the mullahs are worse than he was, aren't they?
Well, you know, like I said, I wasn't around during Mossadegh. This a long time ago, but I can tell you this. The mullahs are rather incompetent at governing. They're better than they were in the 90s, but nobody is providing them with any sense of education, any investment, any hope. So they're going to be one of the poorest, if not the poorest country on earth, and they're going to have one of the worst, most incompetent governments. So, you know, I don't know how you fix that. I don't know how you go into a country that is that poor. And we tried it with money. It didn't work. We tried it with guns. It didn't work. So maybe that's its natural state.
Going to take calls with Robert Young Pelton next hour. Robert, how concerned are you about domestic terrorism?
Well, you know, one of the reasons I picked terrorism as my topic tonight was I don't think people really watch terrorism that much. We saw it in Gaza, of course. We saw a massive uptick in deaths and kidnappings.
Horrible.
And we were shocked because, you know, since 2017, terrorist attacks have been going down. So you could statistically say, well, you know, we're past, you know, the bad old days. But the types of terrorism are more and more frightening. And I'm talking about school shootings, January 6th, Gaza, lone wolf attacks, you know, things like that. And that doesn't include state-sponsored terrorism like you see in Russia or hacker attacks or, you know, poisonings and assassinations.
Mm-hmm.
We've entered a whole new different world is where terrorism is the norm. It's easier to use an attack by, let's say, Hezbollah than it is for Iran to declare war on, let's say, Saudi Arabia. And when an attack happens in Israel, it doesn't affect just Israel. It affects the entire world, the whole economy, the outlook of people shifts dramatically. So we are very much affected by terrorism, and terrorism is back.
How many terrorists do you think are out there in the Middle East running around?
Oh, God. You know what they say, one man's terrorist is another man's freedom fighter. It doesn't take a lot. So, for example, if you label Hezbollah as a terrorist organization, you could just say, well, there's 60,000 members of Hezbollah. But that's not the actual number of people who might get upset and attack Israel, right? Because you've also got Gaza, who Hamas says they have 40,000 fighters. I don't think they have 40,000 fighters. But it's not a numeric thing. It's an asymmetrical warfare. You know, you only need one well-placed bomb and a bus to you know, basically knock a nation to its knees, because the standard sense of security is erased. You only need one airliner shot down for people to just not want to fly anymore. So yeah. When Russia shoots down an airliner, that's an act of terrorism that terrifies the entire world, even though it was meant, you know, in Ukraine.
What's happening around the planet in other countries like Russia, like China? Do they have these acts of terrorism?
Terrorist tactics. And obviously we could argue about whether the nuclear bomb was a terrorist act or whether, you know,
stop the war, right?
So when you declare war, like when Russia declared war on Ukraine, they used both terrorist tactics and also traditional warfare. But if you look at something, let's say like Wagner, you know, the former Wagner group, they're hiring criminals out of prison, telling them to kill and steal whatever they want, and then those people are coming back into society. And so we're normalizing terrorism. If you look at January 6th, we can say that that wasn't a terrorist attack. There was no organization. But, you know, stochastic terror, which is in which somebody calls for something to happen, and it happens, whether it's a lone wolf or whether it's a large group, is a very real thing these days because of social media.
The guy who was the head of the Wagner group that apparently died in a plane crash, did he?
Yeah. Well, so Prigozhin, a very interesting guy, and I think I told you he wanted me to make a documentary about Wagner, and I was reticent to do that. But he was trying to legitimize the idea of private military companies, and he was very much dependent on the Russian military for his bullets, his artillery, his food. And that's an incredibly corrupt organization.
Yeah.
Russia's famous for corruption. And he got very angry, and he went to overthrow the government. And, you know, not coincidentally, he fell out of the tallest window that Putin could find, which was, you know, 30,000 feet up. But the organization still exists, even though they're trying to tear it apart. They're actually assimilating it into the Russian military, and they still function in places like Africa.
How much power does Putin control out there?
Well, in Russia, of course, everything.
Yeah.
If you even talk, I mean, you've seen those people with blank signs protesting get arrested immediately. You've seen newscasters even mention the war or the losses. They go to prison. So he has absolute power. He also is very good at soft power in terms of influencing people to think that, you know, his thinking is the positive or the way forward. You know, he supports Gaza just like other people do who want to split the relationship between America and Israel. So he's also meddling in other people's politics in Europe and America. So he's quite busy.
Did you hear that story in my news segment about Putin and ordering women to have more kids?
Well, that's the problem. You know, Russia's dying out. And this is one of the problems of Russia, is that it was losing men at an astounding rate, and now they're incinerating them. I mean, there's like a meat grinder. You know, if you imagine a sausage factory, I don't know how many, 150,000 or something. They lost 10,000 men in like 1 week. They lost 1,000 in 1 day. That's 1,000 less parents, you know, fathers of kids. So, yeah, he's got a real problem.
Robert, what does it mean by state-sponsored terrorism?
Well, there's a couple of ways of looking at that. One is a government can literally just terrorize another nation. And this goes back to, let's say, Genghis Khan, you know, building mountains of skulls. You know, he didn't kill everybody, but he projected terror to get other people to capitulate. There's other examples where there are organizations within the government that do terrible things to people and blame it on the other side, or they, you know, use it to push people out of areas. You know, for example, the war in Sudan now, you could argue that the Southern RSF, the Rapid Security Forces, which is essentially a mercenary group, is pushing people out of their land, excuse me, by raping, killing, burning. I mean, these are all terror tactics. And, you know, I spent a lot of time in warfare in Africa, and that's how they scare people away. And the entire population will flee. So there's many different versions of it, but it's very common.
Is it controllable?
Well, I pose a question to you. You know, we watch Russia. We watch what they do to civilians.
Right.
And we don't do anything about it. We have the UN, which is basically done, has little to no authority, and we just tut-tut about it. But the only way we can stop it is by being more forceful than the person who causes the terror.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpert.
It's just a shame, you know, that they took him from us.
Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, knocking on doors, uncovering new evidence, including the DNA of a potential killer.
My name is Danny Smith. I'm a detective with the Miramar Police Department. This is Scott Weinberger. We're actually reopening an old case, and your name came up.
Untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one murder, but almost a dozen.
I thought they were going to kill me, so I kept my mouth shut, and I didn't say anything. All these years, I didn't say anything.
Listen to Cold-Blooded, The Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
We started talking about this incident. Drugs and officials cover up. You couldn't believe it.
From iHeart Podcasts.
It's like the police knew who he was before they got here.
A story about money, power, and corruption.
The medical school dean at USC was leading a secret double life.
He's breathing right now?
Yes, he's absolutely breathing. I'm a doctor, actually.
There's no way that guy's a doctor.
I'm Paul Pringle, and I'm an investigative reporter for the LA Times. This is the story of an investigation that starts in a hotel room in Pasadena, California, and reaches all the way to the top of two of the most powerful institutions in the city of Los Angeles.
When people fall in line, they fall in line.
Looking back, I realized, oh, everyone knew.
This is Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption.
We're always going to have predators. It's the good people who stand by and do nothing that allow them to flourish.
Listen to Fallen Angels, a story of California corruption on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcast, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Are you ready to fight back against crime? Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies, personally investigating, prosecuting, and covering literally thousands of cases. It's so easy to think it will never happen to me or my family, but that is simply not true. Every day on Crime Stories with Nancy Grace, we shine a light on unsolved homicides, heat up cold cases, and help find missing people, especially children. We speak with family members, investigators, CSI, reporters, and experts in every field. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
You know, what's kind of interesting is we go into Afghanistan because of the 9/11 situation. We go into Iraq. Nobody stops us.
Mm-hmm.
Yet the Soviets go into Ukraine, and it's like it's the end of the world, and everybody goes nuts. Not to say that it was the right move by any means. But why are we allowed to do these things and other nations can't?
Well, okay, so that's a good question, because we went into Afghanistan because it was literally the poorest, weakest nation on earth. So there was nothing to stop us, and we had already set the battlefield as they were the bad guys, we were the good guys. So that was an easy one. Iraq was false pretenses. You know, they thought, well, since we're on a roll, we might as well deal with Iraq and Saddam and all this stuff. And they did fight back. You know, there was an insurgency. A lot of Americans died.
Sure.
And eventually in Afghanistan, they fought back. Taliban organized themselves. And, you know, it's like grabbing a porcupine backwards. It hurts. And finally, we just let go. In the Ukraine, we know exactly what happens if America was to engage with Russia directly. You know, we have the nuclear option. And since the 50s, we've been always thinking, well, what if he pulls the trigger? You know, do we really want to escalate that high? And so we have very, very slow. We invented this in 1947. Our policy is just to frustrate the Russians because they're so incompetent. They're so slow. They're so sort of organically dysfunctional that if we speed them up, they dissolve faster. So we've just been frustrating them, slowly providing weapons, better and better weapons, more and more money. And at some point, the Russians will exhaust themselves.
The late General George Patton, after World War II, wanted us to go over after the Soviets. Was he right?
He was absolutely right because, you know, if you remember, and again, this is before my time, we had initially distrusted the Soviets. We didn't like Stalin. But because the Germans turned on him, we thought, okay, let's kill Russians instead of Americans. So we helped him kill Germans. And when the war became sort of towards the end state, I don't think America thought it was worth just killing more and more Americans. They let the Russians take over the rest of those areas. But the Russians kept them. The Soviet Union kept all those countries, including Berlin. And Patton was quite right by saying you can't trust them. We should push them back to their borders.
And we had the capability of doing that at that time, didn't we?
Yes, we did. And, you know, it's interesting watching how Russians fight and how Westerners fight. And Russians literally throw bodies at bullets. It's almost like an inexhaustible asset they have where they don't really care about casualties. They don't really care about the impact on morale inside the country. But they use waves and waves and waves of people. And when I was in the war in Ukraine, it's just these poor Ukrainians are like, why do they do that? Why do they just keep throwing bodies at us? And we just mow them down. And that's just the Russian way of fighting war.
Are you concerned about China taking over Taiwan?
Well, yes. China has pretty much done everything it said it's going to do. It's just that its calendar is so long. So, you know, as we watch America's sort of focus shift away from Asia and sort of focus towards Europe and other things like Africa and the Middle East, you know, China's just watching and they're calculating at what point does America just shrug their shoulders and just say, oh, well, because, you know, you saw with Hong Kong, it was a very slow erosion of freedom in Hong Kong until suddenly, poof, it was part of China. So I see the same thing happening with Taiwan. And I don't see it as a huge military conflict because it's so far away and it would be so deadly. And at the end of the day, China is also interwoven with America's financial system. And right now is not a good time for China to steal anything because they're hurting and they need friends. And they've been going around the world, you know, trying to be friendly with what were once enemies because they need us to be nice to them now.
We had the atomic bomb, Robert, 5 years before the Soviet Union developed theirs. Why didn't we stop them?
Well, at the time, Russia was not a threat to us. They were a threat to Europe. They were stealing Europe. They were, you know, unbolting all the factories and shipping everything back to Russia. It was clear what they were doing. But it didn't really affect us. You know, our job was to get Hitler gone. And then it was only, I think, what, 4 or 5 years later that we came up with the Marshall Plan and decided that we were going to help Europe get back on their knees. Right. That was our battle with Russia, by the way, was the Marshall Plan.
Paint a picture of the world for me 5-10 years from now.
Oh, man, I'm going to sound dark here, but, well, 5 years is not a long window, but let's say 5 to 10 years. I see the erosion of state powers. I think people are distrusting governments more and more. I think governments and international institutions have less and less impact and reach, and I think small violent groups see opportunities that they can seize, negotiate some kind of deal, and start shaping how the map is drawn. And I have to say, Gaza and Israel is a perfect example of where, I mean, Gaza is, what, 2 miles long or something like that?
Yeah, that's nothing.
The entire world focus is on that conflict. And you have sort of an unsolvable, repeatable problem that is worrying the entire planet, because that's the future right there. Is how do we deal with angry, poor people that don't want to be kept in certain conditions, whether you're talking about Myanmar or whether you're talking about Venezuela? You know, we're seeing migration where people just can't live anymore and they just start moving into other countries. So these violent events create and trigger other things that are even bigger and even more dramatic. So I see a lot more chaos, and I see a lot less governmental positioning, like, we're going to stop this. And, you know, for example, today the U.S. is absolutely terrified of engaging in combat in a foreign country. We'll do it with special forces teams. You know, we'll do it with proxies and things like that. But the idea of troops getting on aircraft and parachuting into a country to wipe out bad guys has vanished.
Did we do that, though, with Afghanistan when we sent 100,000 troops?
Well, okay, so remember, I've been there many times, and I was an advisor for the four-star. So I was there for the 100,000, and I was there when there was only like a couple of dozen people.
Right.
The couple of dozen people actually won the war. It took 2 or 3 weeks, but those advisors and the CIA teams used very little violence, pushed the Taliban to a defeat, and then the State Department stepped in and said, oh, let's rebuild this country. And then we were saying, like, well, it actually never was built, you know, other than areas around Kabul and Kandahar. But they decided that this was going to be a great social experiment, and we were going to pump millions of dollars into Afghanistan. And we did it in the 50s, and it didn't work. You know, people forget that. So the point was that there's two wars. There's the war we won and the war we lost.
Listen to more Coast to Coast AM every weeknight at 1 a.m. Eastern. And go to coasttocoastam.com for more.
I'm Scott Weinberger, journalist and former deputy sheriff. In my new podcast series, Cold-Blooded, I'm embedded in the cold case investigation into the death of firefighter Billy Halpern. Experience this investigation in a truly unique way, untangling secrets that may reveal the answers to not only one case, but almost a dozen. Listen to Cold-Blooded, the Apollo Gym Murders on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hi guys, Nancy Grace here, host of podcast Crime Stories with Nancy Grace. I've dedicated my life to fighting crime and helping crime victims. For a decade, I prosecuted violent felonies. Every day is a mission. Every day is a chance to stop crime and keep one more person safe. Listen to Crime Stories with Nancy Grace on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast.
In the recent history of documentary filmmaking, one scene stands out above all. The hot mic bathroom confession of Robert Durst in The Jinx. Now the person responsible for that moment, Sareb Kaufman, stepson of the victim, friend of the murderer, star of the documentary, for the first time ever, shares why he believes you're watching the furthest thing from the truth on this exclusive episode of Murder Homes. Listen to Murder Homes on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.